The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to the Chilling Effects of Climate Change Denialism panel. I'm Desiree Shell, and I'm the host of Canadian radio show Skeptically Speaking, and I'm the moderator for this panel, and this is part of the fantastic Skepticon track of Convergence. I'll just have our brilliant and insightful panelists introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Maggie Kurthbaker. I am the science editor at boingboing.net. I am also a science journalist for magazines and for the internet. I'm the author of Before the Lights Go Out, which is a book about the electric infrastructure in the United States, where it came from, how it works today, and how it's going to have to change if we're going to make any progress on dealing with our climate problem. There are also jokes.
So I'm John Abraham, and I'm the most boring member up here because I'm not a writer. I'm a scientist. I work in energy and environment, climate science, and I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas, which is here in St. Paul.
John's also one of the founders of the Climate Science Rapid Response Team, which is a really critical service to everybody in the country for dealing with climate denial. My name's Sean Otto. I'm one of the co-founders of ScienceDebate.org, which is a national initiative to get candidates for president to debate the big science policy issues that the nation is facing. I'm also the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America, about science denialism, the history of the relationship between science and democracy, and why suddenly it's become politically acceptable to deny science.
My name is Greg Layden, and I'm a biological anthropologist, and my relationship to climate change is in part that I have actually done research as a paleoanthropologist in the relationship between climate change and human history, and I was on the lake research faculty here at the University of Minnesota, where people go and core in mud puddles and small lakes and that kind of thing. And my other relationship is as a member of the climate science rapid response team and as a science blogger at scienceblogs.com. I'm very much involved in the denialism issue and also the process of interpreting climate science and other science for people to use to in classrooms and to, you know, just know how this stuff works without having to read scientific journals or, even worse, newspapers and magazines.
John, why are climate scientists so convinced that global warming is real?
The idea that humans can warm the planet's not a new idea. We've known it since the 1850s. And over the past 160 years, our knowledge has gotten stronger and stronger. We know humans can cause the climate to change for four reasons. First, we can look through past history, through looking at ice cores or sediments, corals, and so forth. And we've seen that greenhouse gases and temperatures track right on top of each other. We also know, because of lab experiments, we can measure the ability of carbon dioxide and other gases to absorb heat. We also can look at the instrumental record, which is the temperatures of the planet since about 1880, and they have gone up significantly. And then the fourth reason is because we have models, computer models, or virtual reality simulations that incorporate our understanding of the Earth's physics and climate, all the subtopics of climate science, and they show clearly that we expect warming to happen as we continue to emit. So there are really four reasons why we're very convinced. Now, it turns out the general public is becoming more convinced as well. I mean, we've seen incredible temperatures this entire year. We saw a $5.2 billion drought in Texas last year. There was the incredible heat wave in Russia in 2010, where for a period of time, the weather reports were smoky because of the fires. And, of course, there was the heat wave in France in 2003 and the terrible heat wave in Chicago, I think it was 1995. So we're starting to see the impacts. And you can now look out your window and see climate change happening. So for those reasons, we're pretty convinced.
Would you say that from this point on, we're going to continue to see those extreme weather conditions, those extreme storms?
As we warm the planet, we're going to see Some areas get hotter and drier. Some get warmer and wetter. In Minnesota, we expect to see warmer weather, heavier precipitation when it occurs, and more extreme swings from hot and dry to hot and wet. Now, do we expect to see what we're seeing now? No. Actually, we expect it to get worse. This is going to be the usual, and the heat waves in the future will be far worse than they are now.
Maybe if we could help people out, what is the strongest argument that you've seen against climate change, and how do you respond to it?
First of all, there aren't any strong ones. Okay, so I'm going to take a weak one and I'm going to pretend it's strong. The strongest arguments that we've seen are that there are natural oscillations, in particular in the oceans, and they are causing the climate change. Almost every real practicing scientist realizes that that's a pretty weak argument. And in the scientific community, about 97% of climate scientists agree humans are causing the majority of climate change. 3% either think we don't know and we have to wait and see, or there are other natural causes. The problem with the oscillation concept is that, first, there isn't an oscillation that's been identified that tracks with temperature. And secondly, even if there was one, those people still admit that you would have warming with emissions. So they have to somehow cancel out the impact of greenhouse gases, and then they add their own source of climate change, which they haven't identified yet. So they have really two leaps of logic.
Are there any other major myths and misconceptions that you want to clear up about climate change before we move on?
Sure. One major myth is that solar cycles are causing climate change, and that has been completely discredited. One myth is that scientists are debating this issue. Absolutely not. Two studies have clearly shown 97% of climate scientists agree.
Now, Greg, isn't it true that in periods of the Earth's history, it already was warmer?
Yes, it was much, much, much warmer when the Earth was first formed, and it was a fiery ball. And then, again, later when it was cooling down and a bunch of meteors hit it again and it made it hot again. There's a general phenomenon called the Cenozoic cooling, which is basically the last 65 million years we've experienced a general cooling. A planet's going to cool down for a number of reasons over time. And so if we go back enough time, we find a lot of things are different. The amount of oxygen on the Earth is different. The density of the air is probably different. The temperature is different. Mm-hmm. It's the Jurassic Park phenomenon. If you got a bunch of dinosaurs and brought them into the future, like in Jurassic Park, they would be living in a world that was so different that they would not be able to survive. So looking at far back in time, it doesn't matter whether the Earth was warmer or cooler, and it's been both warmer and cooler in the past. The more relevant time period would be the last few thousand years, and there's a reasonably good argument has been made that it's been warmer within the last few thousand years, the medieval warm period or whatever. But as we look at the data more closely, we're not really seeing that hold up. The global temperature was not higher than it is now. There have been periods of time when a given local area might show warmer records for a period of time, but not globally. The thing that scares me and worries me and interests me the most is the Eemian period, the last interglacial. So we went through a glacial period that ended 10, 12,000 years ago. Those of you who live in Minnesota know the evidence of the glacial period because we are surrounded by the geological evidence of what the glacier left behind here. The glacial period lasted tens of thousands of years, and it ended, the previous interglacial sort of ended about 14,000 years ago. And that previous interglacial, which is like it is now, is a period of time of several thousand years long that's like the present. And when you look at the evidence, trees were growing that should have been farther south were farther north. Plants in general were farther north. Temperature indicators in the Antarctic and the Arctic, Greenland and elsewhere, indicate warmer temperatures. Yet there was less carbon in the air. Carbon levels at that time were lower than they are now. They're pre-global warming, pre-anthropogenic global warming carbon levels, which conflicts with the reality that carbon tracks temperature, okay? But there's an explanation for this, and that is that the Earth is a big round thing, and the equator points at the sun, and the sun heats up the equatorial regions, and then the heat goes from the equatorial regions out towards the poles using a series of circulations of air and water. And there's more than one way this could be configured. And it can be configured in such a way that we have very mild winters in Minnesota like we had last year. That was because of a configuration of the air circulation. And so basically what was happening during that Eemian period was for long periods of time, the temperature was more evenly distributed over the Earth. So that means that higher latitudes were warmer than they are now, relatively. But the entire planet was not warmer. It was cooler. And this is scary because the high latitudes were warmer. There was far less ice trapped in glaciers in the Antarctic and in Greenland, probably. And sea levels were significantly higher, 6, 8, 12 feet higher than they are now, with less carbon in the air. And that bothers me because if you change the climate by heating up the Earth, then it could shift into a different modality, which we have seen evidence of, where air and water circulation changes. And we could, the idea is over the next century we're going to have about a meter increase of, is our estimate. That's crap. It's so variable. It could be anything. We're not going to have no increase in sea level. It could be a half a meter. It could be a meter. It could be 2 meters. It could be 3 meters. We really just don't know how high sea level is going to go and when it's going to happen. Or, and this will be really interesting to watch it happen. I mean, imagine that large portions of the glaciers turning into slush and then dumping into the ocean all at once, something like that. There could be very rapid change in sea level rise. And we just have no model for how fast glaciers melt or how slow they melt and how sea level changes from meltwater going in. So the evidence for warmer times in the past is actually not evidence for warmer times in the relevant past. It's evidence for the Earth being configured slightly different. And there's no reason I can think of that the Earth can't be reconfigured that way now. The continents are in the same positions they were then. Mm-hmm. The oceans are in the same position they were then. Is kind of a wobbly top, you know, like we could just wobble this way or we could wobble that way, and their circulation systems could shift in such a way that global warming, not only do we get warmer, but we get a lot warmer in the higher latitudes.
So although there is no conflict or barely any conflict within the scientific community about climate change, there is indeed conflict within the political community and the government. And this is not the only area where there is denialism. Could you just talk about what science denialism is, Sean?
Well, it's the same thing as what some people call anti-science when it gets into the political realm. For instance, Chairman Mao was considered anti-science. Stalin was considered anti-science because they ignored the evidence of science in basing public policy and instead based it on fairly rigid ideology. So when that charge started to be thrown around early in the Republican primary cycle this time, John Huntsman responded to it by saying, you know, we can't become known as the anti-science party. The problem that has cropped up is that there's a split that happened in U.S. science politics, really around the growth of environmental regulatory science. And the growth of the biological sciences. This is in the 1970s when we became able to control the life cycle, which offended fundamentalists and religious conservatives for a variety of reasons because it was interfering with God's plan. We also became aware of the environmental effects of the chemical revolution and of other industrial science that we had rushed into mass commercialization before we were aware that it could have biocomplex effects or health effects. And so a lot of negative effects started boomeranging back at us. DDT, you know, kids in the 50s would play in the fog of DDT as they sprayed the neighborhoods. And then in 1962, Rachel Carson's book comes out, Silent Spring, and we realize it's a toxin. Then moving on, the Delcon shield and all kinds of things that might be causing cancer. There were a lot of negatives suddenly to science, but a lot of those negatives were focused at industry. Industry, especially the older industries, the petrochemical industries that were based on the science of the late 1800s and early 1900s, found themselves really aligned with religious conservatives. And this science issue and this split over the growth of environmental regulatory science and the biological sciences has really defined the modern American political party structures between Democrats and Republicans. And it's all circling around science and science that is sometimes inconvenient. These people have large vested interests in denying the science that contradicts their business model or the ideological structure that secures their foundation if they're conservative faith. So this confluence has empowered fundamentalists by giving them a lot of money from industry, and we've seen a lot of new bills coming through about denial of evolution in public schools, and they are being conflated with denial of climate change. And these two groups have begun to work together and use many of the same tools, saying we should debate the controversy and we shouldn't be scared of critical thinking, as if they were the same thing. The problem is that this is equating knowledge from science on one side with received wisdom from ideology on the other, and acting as if opinion and knowledge were the same and that we could settle them somehow through a rhetorical debate. But we can't do that. That's not the way that the world works, and that's not the way that our democracy works either. We were supposed to be basing things on the best available knowledge. So this is causing great problems in our political system right now. And when you see politicians now that are being called anti-science, it's usually because of the heavy influence of in their party structure. Sometimes it's Democrats, sometimes it's Republicans, of these issues. I should say, to be fair, Democrats can be also anti-science. Generally, that is about undue suspicion against big pharma or undue suspicion against agriculture. Some of it is well-founded, but some of it is not. There's ideas that your cell phone could cause brain cancer. Absolutely no science to support that. Or there's ideas that vaccines might cause autism. No science to support that either. So on the left, it's about biological or environmental purity, and on the right, it's anti-regulatory and anti-control of the reproductive cycle.
Something that both parties have in common. How nice. So what are the effects, then, of science denialism on climate change or the climate change issue?
Well, the biggest effect is that we're not making progress. The United States is really the largest consumer of energy, and yet we are the most rigid in our denial of science. We are the world leader in science denial now, closely followed by the United Kingdom. You could see its effect in 2010 in the run-up to the climate bill. Energy industry lobbying groups spent about $500 million in the 9 months prior to that vote. The Obama administration decided that they had to choose between health care and climate, and they backed off on climate. They did not push it. And after the election, there was no hope of doing that because 94 out of the 100 new Tea Party / Republican members of Congress have either stated that they think that climate change is a worldwide socialist hoax, that scientists are in it for the money. I saw what John drove today, and it was a really...
I told the wonderful lady who drove my car to a parking spot, just ignore the rattling sounds.
I don't know many climate scientists who have their midlife crisis red Ferrari.
Yeah.
I've actually seen what Greg drives, too, and it's not very impressive, frankly. So I don't think that's the case, but these people actually believe this. And Maggie talks a lot about this, about how the country is split over the political side of this question. And ways that we need to begin to kind of heal that political rift.
And Maggie, that's what I was going to ask you about. How has climate change denialism affected the revamping of energy policy as you've called for it?
Well, what I think is really interesting is that if you actually look at people's thoughts on energy and what they support in favor of energy change, what you find is that a majority of Americans, a large majority of Americans, including a large majority of Republicans, support the kind of energy policies that would help deal with the climate change problem. There has been poll after poll showing this, and it doesn't go down, you know, during the time that belief in climate change was going down. This was not going down. This was actually going up. So when you actually look at the stuff we need to do, people are in favor of the stuff we need to do. The problem is that people have these ideological associations with that stuff that they don't feel like they can support things that, I guess, separate them from their tribe. And that's where you start to have some problems. And I think that this is made worse partly by the fact that a lot of times when we sit around and look at some of these things, some of this denialism stuff, we have a tendency to respond in like, oh, these people are stupid. Oh, these people are addled by religion. Let's make fun of them and point and laugh. But if you actually look at what's going on behind the scenes, it's usually a lot of money and some very logical decision making that's manipulating people that for very good reasons are not up on constantly changing science. If you think about the amount of science education that we have in the US, I believe that it's something like only 30% of American adults have ever taken a higher level than high school science class. Most of us, what we know about science is what we learned in high school. And science keeps changing from that point. So you're told these extreme facts of this is how this works, this is like being handed down, received information from authority, but the information continues to change. And the only way that you get any kind of update on that information, the only way that you actually get to understand how science works is through things like the media, is through things like science museums. Those are pretty much your only sources of ongoing science education in America. And so when you have things behind the scenes manipulating how that information comes across through blogs and through the trusted sources that people turn to, through their friends, through their pastors, what you get is poor information. And that's not because those people are stupid. It's because, like almost all of the rest of us, they can't be experts in everything. I think that a really good example of this is yesterday we were talking about the North Carolina sea level rise. Where North Carolina's state legislature tried to ban the idea that sea level rise was happening and we're going to call it recurrent flooding and we're going to only use data from historical sea level rise in that region rather than what's actually projected because of climate change changes that don't apply to the past levels. If you actually look at what was going on with that, that wasn't a crazy, stupid religion thing. That was people that owned the rights to develop coastal hotels who knew that if you're using the projections that are scientifically based, their insurance rates are going to become completely and utterly impossible. That was a calculated economic political move, not stupid religious people. And I think that that's something that we really need to keep in mind, because we talk a lot about how the mainstream media gets science wrong and how there is very legitimately this problem with newspapers trying to show both sides of the issue, even when one side that they're showing is clearly false. But I think that there's also a problem when you look at the blogosphere with people preaching to the choir or people using a tone of conveying information that's not going to reach anybody except people who already completely 100% agree with them, and in fact is going to turn off the people that don't 100% already agree with them because you're insulting them. And one of the things that Desiree had asked me about was how you tell the difference between denialism and legitimate criticism. One of the ways that I tell that through is the tone of the writing. And if the tone of the writing that's attached to legitimate science has that attacking, mocking, you know, writing off tone that gets attached to denialism, I'm going to lump that in with the denialism if I don't know the science well enough.
There are two studies that show that the more highly educated a Republican is, the more likely they are to deny that climate change is happening. And similarly, the more highly educated a Democrat is, the more likely that they're going to have suspicions about vaccination and whether or not the vaccines might cause autism. In fact, there are packets of vaccine refusal that are associated with Whole Foods shoppers. We really can't conclude, she's right, we really can't conclude that it has anything to do with people being stupid or being uneducated. In fact, just the opposite, that people become more skeptical and feel more entitled to question authority when they are educated. The problem is which authority are they questioning and which authority are they aligning with? Ultimately, any science can become politicized. The theory of relativity became politicized in the 1920s in Weimar, Germany. Albert Einstein at the time, there's a great quote in my book, he wrote a friend saying, it's amazing, every coachman and every waiter is debating whether relativity theory is correct or not. Belief in this matter depends on political party affiliation. So these things happen, and they happen because exactly for the reasons that Maggie said, that we don't have time to become experts on everything. When science is not apparent to the eye, it becomes invisible. And your iPhone might as well have been created by Harry Potter than by scientists. So if that's true, then both become a matter of belief. So the question then is where do you go for your sources of information? And what beliefs do you use in making good judgment? That's why the press is so critical, in my view, to this issue. And that's why it's become such a problem, this idea in the press, that we have to show a balance between knowledge on the one hand and opinion on the other in order to be fair to, quote unquote, both sides.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at a possible future where integrated technology makes exchanging digital information as natural as using the senses we're born with. We'll spend the hour with technology writer Michael Korist to talk about his book Worldwide Mind, The Coming Integration of Humanity, Machines, and the Internet. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome to Who Will Save the Polar Bears? I'm Desiree Schell, and I'll be the moderator for this panel as part of the fabulous Skepticon Skeptic Track. We have on the far left, Maggie Kurth Baker. She's the author of Before the Lights Go Out and is the science editor for Boing Boing. And next to her, we have Sean Otto. He's the founder of Science Debate 08 and 2012, and the author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. Finally, we have Greg Layden, a science communicator formerly of the Lake Research Center faculty who has studied paleoclimate. So maybe we'll start with Greg. If you could start by telling us about the effects of climate change, both the more and less obvious ones.
We'll focus specifically on the effects of increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide by releasing carbon dioxide from fossil fuels where it's been stored for anywhere from hundreds to millions of years of time, and now we're releasing that into the air. And the CO2 in the air causes the atmosphere of the planet and then indirectly the oceans of the planet to be warmer. So the effects are it's warmer. You may have noticed that. We might be experiencing this year one of the warmest years on record. We're not sure. The year's only halfway through. It could get really cold the rest of the year. The effects are changes in weather patterns. We don't fully understand all this, but the distribution of heat, as heat moves from the equator towards the poles, it follows certain patterns. So it might be a relatively warm in the southern parts of the United States, but cool in the northern parts of the United States. We had a very warm winter last year. Europe had a very cold winter. These patterns are probably affected by changes in what the atmosphere can hold in terms of heat. There's probably an increase in the increase in energy results in an increase in storm activity. It might involve in some areas an increase in aridity, in other areas an increase in moisture. It probably means in many areas more rain that comes in big batches, meaning you get droughts interrupted by floods. Another effect that people have to remember is that with the CO2 in the atmosphere, that also increases the amount of CO2 in the ocean, and that results in a shift in pH in the ocean. So the ocean becomes more acidic, and it's possible that the ocean could become too acidic in certain areas that a lot of organisms that we sort of expect to live there won't do well because they have shells that are and body parts that are made out of things that dissolve in the more acidic water. Changes in ocean chemistry are probably the reason for the end Permian extinction, which is since multicellular life evolved on Earth, was probably the biggest. There were two of them in a row, and they were probably the biggest extinctions that happened. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to do that, but I'm just saying that ocean chemistry is important, and we just don't want to forget ocean chemistry. And finally, sea level rise. As the poles become warmer and other regions become warmer, ice that is currently in glaciers normally melts, and the sea level goes up from that, and the ocean simply just like if the liquid in the thermometer goes up, when the temperature goes up, the liquid in the ocean goes up too, but it's the ocean. And so because the ocean becomes warmer and filled with more water, it rises. And that's actually where some of my paleo research has been on, is sea level change. And, you know, that could be a very important factor in the short term, or it might not be a big factor for a few decades and then become a big factor later on.
Now, those are still, if not obvious, at least some of the things that we do hear about. But there are other effects that are more tangible, such as the effect on agriculture.
There's a whole bunch of other possible effects. For example, the kinds of pathogens that live on plant affect plants. Wild plants, like just trees that live in, you know, not agricultural products. If you go to some parts of the United States now, there's an awful lot of dead trees. And the reason the trees are dead is because certain parasites have killed them. And those parasites are parasites that are living there because of the warmer climate. And then, of course, we get warmth leads to more evaporation. We're currently experiencing record low levels of moisture in trees. This could result in some forest fires. And you may have noticed that we're having the worst forest fire year on record in the American Rockies right now. Agriculture is, and all kinds of just anything that involves plants and animals, develops in place with the assumption of certain basic background things. Imagine if the sun just became half as dark, or you know, half as much light coming from it, or if the relative humidity in the desert just tripled. The plants in the desert are adapted to low humidity, and plants that are not adapted to low humidity would become weeds and take over. If you change the basic parameters of a habitat, you're going to change everything, and you're going to have local extinctions and local invasions and so on. And that includes pathogens that affect agriculture and so on. One of the things I guess I should say is people think about climate change as the future, something that will happen if we don't do something. But there has been desertification and changes in weather patterns that have affected agriculture going on since the 1970s. Climate change is caused by carbon release that has been going on since the 1820s. And climate denialists often say, oh, it was really warm in 1899. It's like, well, excuse me, but 1899 was after 90 years of releasing CO2. It's a long-term process. It's been going on a long time. And a lot of the things that we've seen in agricultural failures and famines and desertification, some of that could be linked to climate change. And we're seeing that just in more accelerated form now. And I think the future could be worse than the present and the past, but it isn't as though climate change and its effects are something in the future. It's something actually currently occurring and that have been occurring for many decades.
I do want to just touch on one thing, because when I heard it, I was terrified. And since we're talking about doom right now, one of the things that might change is, or has changed already to a certain extent, is disease patterns.
I guess to make a very general statement about this, okay, most epidemic diseases that we experience as humans are the effects of changes that humans have made in the environment. And climate change has increased diseases in certain regions and caused shifts in the patterns of diseases that are just beginning to be recognized now. And it's not my area, I don't know a lot about it, but it is an area of concern. And it's interesting because we have become a little bit complacent about disease in some ways, because, you know, in the 1940s, the thing that killed people who were otherwise healthy other than violence was, you know, infections. And they invented antibiotics and solved that problem. And now we realize, well, actually that was only bacteria and it wasn't viruses and so on. And I think that as we change the environment and the context for diseases changes for them to thrive, these are not effects that we can just fix with technology by just coming up with another vaccination.
Maggie, in Before the Lights Go Out, you talked about how our use of energy has affected climate change and how climate change has affected energy. So maybe can you just give us some background on that?
I think the right place to start with this is, what do you think we use most of our energy in the U.S. for? What do you think is our biggest use of energy? It's buildings. And particularly it is the big kind of public buildings. Our schools, our hotels, our businesses, our office buildings, those kind of things use an immense amount of energy, primarily for heating and cooling. And we use more energy for buildings right now in the U.S. than we do for transportation. And part of what I think is really interesting about that is the fact that we're using all of that energy to sort of perfect an indoor climate in a way that is affecting our outdoor climate in a way that forces us to then keep perfecting our indoor climate. And it becomes this sort of cyclical loop. Here in Minnesota, I've had my air conditioner turned on more than I ever have in the 7 years that I've lived here this summer. And that has an impact. It has an impact not only on fossil fuel emissions, but it also has an impact on the stability of our grid systems. If you look at what's been happening with grid systems around the U.S. this year, what you find is that we have had a lot of blackouts that have been caused by heat waves coming through that were not totally expected, and so you had a increase in demand for electricity happening at a point when we didn't have enough electricity to meet that demand. And that's one of the really interesting things about how the grid works. It's actually a lot more precarious than you think it is. We have to have almost a perfect balance between electric supply and electric demand at any given point in time. And if that gets out of whack by even fractions of a percent, we get blackouts. So when you have heat waves, you have blackouts. When you have surprise cold snaps and storms that people aren't expecting, you have blackouts. And all of these things are then tied back to these kind of climate change effects that Greg was talking about.
So, Sean, what was the political response to these kind of issues?
Nothing. an attempt was made in 2010, shortly after President Obama was elected, appointed his administration, and before the 2010 election, since it looked like that was going to turn over. But there was a lot of money that was being poured in, about $500 million. Half $1 billion was being poured in by the energy industry into lobbying Congress, roughly about $1,400 per member per day to defeat the climate bill that occurred. And the Obama administration, I think, had to make a calculated decision about what they thought, in light of the economic downturn, was going to affect people more directly, health care or climate. And they went with health care. And as a result, the climate bill really went down because of those two factors. There has been a lot of political movement since then, particularly on the right, to avoid mitigation efforts. South Dakota has passed a resolution saying that there are many things that could cause climate change and that we should teach all of them, including the astrological factors.
Seriously?
Yes. Yeah. Many states actually are coming up with this teach the controversy idea, that there is a significant scientific controversy about climate change. There really is not. The controversy is a political one. But the idea then that you should teach both sides of a controversial subject, nobody should be scared of critical thinking, is a way of turning skepticism on its head by equating an opinion with actual knowledge developed from science and acting as if they are the same thing, and then that we can debate one thing or another, which isn't the case. There have been other legislative attempts to make things like sea level rise illegal. I don't think it'll work, but it might. The South Carolina or North Carolina Republicans in the state legislature recently put out a bill that didn't pass but just came within a hair's breadth of passing that would make it illegal for any local community to plan for mitigation for sea level rise. All these coastal communities we're talking about, and they're thinking, we've got to do something to make plans to be responsible. Well, the legislature steps in and says, well, sorry, you can't consider that unless the state legislature gives you permission to talk about it. You can't consider it in your planning. And furthermore, if you do consider it, you can't go with the science. You have to go with which says about a meter rise over the next century, roughly. I mean, the preponderance of the evidence suggests that it'll be about a meter rise in sea level. They say you've got to go with our number, which is 8 inches. So they're legislating facts, apparently, now. And I didn't realize that they had that power, but I'm happy that they do. It makes me feel a whole lot better about all of it, because then we can just make it go away. Virginia recently followed suit saying that we can't talk about sea level rise. We've got to refer to it as recurrent flooding because sea level rise is a liberal code word. So those kind of sort of absurd conversations are going on between politicians about this issue because it is a thorny economic issue that we really don't want to have to deal with. So we're trying to legislate it out of existence, or we're denying that it's happening, or throwing up a bunch of smoke screens to delay the discussion. And that's, you know, if there's about $3 trillion of hydrocarbons left in the ground, it's worth throwing, you know, a couple billion dollars at trying to hold it off. So from an economic point of view, it makes sense. And in a way, you almost can't blame the corporations that are engaging in this, because they are, at least to the public ones anyway, the Koch Industries is a private organization, private corporation, but the public ones are, according to our economic structure, required by law to perform only in the interests of their shareholder performance, and they have to do it on a quarterly basis, which almost requires them to chase the lowest production cost, the lowest regulation, to externalize any kind of cost that they can. So our economic system is what's driving a good part of the politics behind this.
Maggie, have there been any energy-related bills that might affect climate change?
There have been attempts at them. I mean, I think obviously the biggest thing was the attempts made to have some kind of price put on carbon, which I think is one of those things that I thought I might be against until I actually did the research for my book and kind of changed my mind on it, mainly because through the course of researching my book, I realized that energy isn't our sources and it's not our individual choices. Energy is systems. What I mean by that is there is only so far that you or I can get anywhere just by what we end up choosing to do at home. I can hop out my front door down by Lake Harriet and I can get on the number 6 bus and I can go anywhere in the city I pretty much want to. I've got great bicycle access, and so because of that, I have one car that my husband and I share, and during the summer we bike a whole lot and we don't really have too much of a problem with needing a second car. But my family in Kansas City doesn't have that kind of infrastructure. And if I told them, well, you should only own one car and you should bike less, I'd be telling them to shoot themselves in the foot. Because without that infrastructure, and without that infrastructure, without a second car, they're going to not be able to access their jobs. They're not going to be able to access the services they need and want. They're not even going to be able to participate in their communities in a really full way. And everyone wants those things out of their life. And so if you're faced with a decision between shooting yourself in the foot and using energy, you're going to use energy. And that's not your fault. That's the fault of the way the system is designed. The only way that I really see of changing the way that our infrastructure systems work on that kind of national scale, global scale, really, that we have to, is to actually price fossil fuels at what they're really worth to us. It's not about punishing them. It's about looking at these things that are incredibly powerful sources of energy, far more powerful than anything else we've ever really found, and we treat them like dirt. Gasoline is so cheap that my mother can get on her ATV in Missouri and drive around for no reason other than just having a good time. And gasoline is this incredibly powerful resource that we have limited amounts of and we're never going to have again once we run out of it. So pricing it at a cheap rate doesn't necessarily make sense. Also, using gasoline has all these external costs that we don't take into account. You know, it has effects on health. It has effects on, through climate change, on things like recurrent flooding. And all of those things are expensive, and we pay for them. It's not like we're not paying for them right now. You and I pay for them right now. So when we pretend that this fuel doesn't have those costs, we're not really treating it as like a real economic system. We're treating it as this special case thing where we just pretend what it's actually worth. And so I think that one of the valuable things about something like a carbon tax or a cap and trade type of system, I'm not really sure which one is the best, economists will debate this to the grave, is that it starts to actually value these things and what they're worth to us, and then it starts to make change happen on the large scale by simply making the right thing to do the cheap thing to do.
And this is something that actually you touched on in your book, the idea that it doesn't matter if you believe in climate change or not. There are really good reasons to pay attention to energy policy and maybe reforming the grid or revamping the grid.
There are lots of people, even if they don't believe in climate change, who care about energy change and want to see energy change happen. There's a group called the Climate and Energy Project in Kansas that has done these focus groups where they brought people in Wichita and Kansas City to kind of find out what they actually thought about climate and energy. And they kept over and over having the same situation where you'd have this guy who thought that climate change was a socialist plot, but when you asked him about energy, he had bought a Prius, changed out all his light bulbs to CFLs, and he was really excited about wind power. And that was not a disconnect to him, because he cared about those things legitimately and genuinely. He just cared about them for different reasons than I do. I don't think we should stop talking about climate change. I don't think we should stop trying to show people that this evidence exists and that this is actually happening, and start trying to create spaces where people can feel comfortable acknowledging that this is happening without feeling like they have to abandon everything else they believe in. But I think we also have to start trying to use these openings that are available to us and try to find these places where we can connect with people and say, you know, you think this is important for this reason, I think it's important for this reason, but let's go ahead and do it because we agree that it's important, so who the hell cares why?
And so would you say then that the main source of criticism about climate change is ideological?
It's completely ideological. It's a tribal thing. And I noticed this with my own family. I have had my stepfather has literally like pulled me aside and in this conspiratorial, don't tell anyone sort of voice, told me that he's pretty sure that he has actually noticed things changing over the past 30 years. He can't believe that that's climate change, but it's different. And he's an outdoorsman. He spends all of his life out in the forest shooting and hunting and boating and all sorts of things like that. He notices this stuff. But, you know, if you feel like by saying this might be climate change, you're at the same time denying your religion, denying your culture, denying your family, why would you even make that step? What we have to do is try to find ways to disconnect that from that tribalism, because if it's connected to that tribalism, how do you get people? There's no way you can convince them with facts, because they're too scared to let go of everything that they know about their lives.
And so I assume the extension of that is within the political system. Correct, Sean?
Well, economics is politics, and the foundation of the economy is the environment. You know, I often talk about the effects of the movie An Inconvenient Truth, because besides being a science writer, I'm also a screenwriter. And I think that they, the producers of the movie, made a strategic error there. They made Al Gore the focus of that movie. He was the star of the movie. The movie was about Al Gore and about his struggle to convince everyone of climate change. And that associated climate change so closely with a prominent Democratic political figure that it became very, very difficult for conservatives to admit that there might be some validity to it, politically. Intellectually, it's a different topic, and intellectually, you can have your quiet doubts, as Maggie's dad does. And I've had a lot of people actually come up to me and kind of on the down low, you know, say similar things. But it's amazing how difficult it is, because it is very much a betrayal of your group. And so I agree that we need to depoliticize it and depoliticize, you know, a lot of these science issues that have become political because of their economic impact.
So since we're starting to touch on the topic of solutions, what do you got?
I actually worked with a candidate for Congress in the 3rd District. I'd never worked on a campaign before as an employee. And this year I was an employee on the staff of a campaign. And it brought me in rooms with current and former legislators regularly. So I was sitting there talking to the Speaker of the House at the state level or the Senate or whatever. And it was very interesting to me because energy was a big part of the discussion. And there was a whole, my candidate's focus was green energy. She had been involved in green energy from early on in her career as an engineer. But in that conversation, I realized how often people were talking to each other, having conversations, the conversations you may experience more often, where people are talking about energy. The thing is, people are having conversations about energy, about what works and what doesn't work, and they're all speaking out of their nether regions most of the time. And I'm talking about politicians, I'm talking about advisors to politicians, I'm talking about regular people, and it's not their fault. What you need to do is read these two people's books seriously. Like, how many of you knew that buildings were the number one energy consumer? Everybody thought it was your SUVs. Well, the SUVs are probably important too, but there's just stuff that people who are engaged in this conversation don't know. And this reminds me of the education debate. I'm very much involved in the creation evolution debate. You know, so I end up in rooms of people talking about education and what to do there. And the same things, people will raise their hand and say the same things again and again and again and again and again. And they're all just stuff people say. And none of it ever has anything to do with any of the science of education or how it should be done or how things should be operated. I think we need to be more informed and more knowledgeable as citizens to have these conversations and to insist that our leaders have that knowledge and recognize it. Several years ago, I was teaching a course in evolution at the University of Minnesota. I do, in my typical course, I do a whole bunch of stuff on how the Earth's climate system works. So at some moment, I have these 500 undergraduates in the room who at this moment in time, the ones that were paying attention, understand Hadley cells. They understand Milankovitch cycles. They understand ocean circulation systems. And just enough that I can then explain how ice ages turn on and off and also what's happening now with climate change, at least what we know about it. And having done that, a student came over to me one day and said, my mother is really mad that you're teaching this because, you know, you're telling us this political one side of the story that global warming is for real and you shouldn't be doing this as a university professor. And the next day he comes back and says, my mother is introducing legislation to stop you from doing what you're doing. This is like 2 lectures later. And his mother was a member of the state legislature. She's now in another position for the federal government.
Ah, our old friend Michelle.
Maybe. So, yes, it's true. I started Michelle Bachmann's federal career, I'm afraid, by getting her pissed off because I was teaching about climate change. And the reason she was upset, I think, was not because of climate change in those days so much as because it was just science. It was already bad that her son had to be taking an evolution course, possibly. And it was a time when a lot of people were coming out who were anti-evolutionists, who were creationists, were coming out and joining the climate change denialism bandwagon. And then professionals took over. And professional lobbyists have taken over the issue a lot more. But it is still a general anti-science and science denialist framework that people are working in. And they can do that. You can walk around and people will tell you, these people that will also sometimes tell you, yeah, I noticed that all the fishing contests I used to be in during the wintertime are now canceled in Minnesota. There's one ice fishing contest left in Minnesota. There used to be 5 or 6. They're all canceled permanently because the lakes don't freeze enough. Okay, people will tell you, yeah, maybe the world is changing. Maybe I noticed something like that going on. But everyone's got their own little 2 or 3 memes of why climate change isn't real, why global warming isn't real, that they know. And they're just walking around with their own little gish gallops with those little bits of facts, and they'll always engage in conversations with those pieces of information. What you need to do as a person who's seriously concerned about these things is know the facts, know what's really going on. You know, read these two guys' books. There's some great websites on climate change. There's Skeptical Science has all of the climate change memes. People say, what about the dinosaurs? You know, there was more CO2. And then there's an answer to that, okay? And the thing is, it is not simple. This is actually more complicated than most science issues that we have to deal with. And the weird thing about it is nothing has changed, hardly at all, in way over 100 years in our understanding of greenhouse effects. This is all old science. We've gotten a lot more detailed, a lot more specific. But at no point does someone go, oh, man, we had the whole thing wrong. That hasn't happened. And not because of conspiracy, but because it's a well enough understood system to know when you put CO2 in the atmosphere, you get things warm. That's been known all along. And what you need to do as a citizen is know the facts and the details better than you do now. And by using some of these resources and become like a, you know, just spend a little time on it so that people can't just roll over you in those cocktail party conversations with their dumb facts about how climate change isn't real.
So Greg wants you to have educated, evidence-based conversations with other humans.
Obviously, a lot of what I've been thinking about in terms of solutions has to do with the grid because that's most of the research that I've done. But I think that there's really something to what Greg was talking about there's just so much that we don't know. And there's so much we don't know about the things that we use every day and the things that affect our lives. And I really ran into this when I was researching the grid because I think it's really unclear to a lot of people where our grid came from and how it functions today. And in particular, you need to know that our electric grid as it currently stands is not a perfect system. It is something that evolved. It was not designed. And it evolved largely in the hands of people who had no idea what they were doing. Some of you probably know that in 1882, Thomas Edison opened the first centralized electric grid in the entire world in New York City. 2 weeks later, the second centralized electric grid in the entire world opened in Appleton, Wisconsin. It was also the site of the first hydroelectric power plant in the entire world. And Appleton was different because Appleton had simply bought the technology to set this up, but they had not brought anybody over from Edison's lab to tell them how to use it. There was no such thing as electrical engineers. There were no such thing as county linemen. There were just a bunch of people inventing things up as they went along. And the grid in Appleton was not optimized to be the best system possible. It was optimized to go up cheaply and to go up quickly. And that showed in what they ended up doing. And one story that I absolutely love from this is that Thomas Edison had invented a voltmeter, which turns out to be this really important thing to actually making sure that your grid is stable and isn't going to start crashing and blacking out on you. But the voltmeter was expensive, so the people in Appleton didn't buy it. And instead, they had a guy who sat in a shack down by the river, and his job was to stare at a light bulb all day long. And if that light bulb got too bright or if it got too dim, then they knew that there was a voltage problem on the grid. These are the kind of systems that our grid as it exists today grew out of. This is something where you had thousands of Appletons all across the US slowly patching themselves together and connecting together into one gigantic thing that we have today. This was not something that was done all at once. It was not even something that was done in any real coordinated way. It evolved, it wasn't designed, it's an imperfect system. So when we talk about things like spending money on a smart grid and figuring out ways to make our grid more stable and to make it a better thing, we're not talking about how we make the world safe for hippies. We're talking about how we take this technology, which quite frankly is largely still sitting in 1970s technology, and how we actually update it to meet the needs of the 21st century. And that's an important story to know if you're going to talk about solutions for climate change, because that's how you start talking to these people that care about energy for reasons other than climate change. And this also ties back to something else Greg was talking about with, you know, how you have these conversations with people and how you actually win those arguments. And storytelling is a huge, huge part of that. Another resource I'd really like to recommend is the Debunker's Handbook, which you can download for free online. And it will tell you actual scientific data about what convinces people and what doesn't. And it turns out that just telling them facts doesn't usually do anything. What's more powerful even than memorizing like a long list of numbers is memorizing one good story. And if you can do that, you can actually start talking to your family and your friends and your political leaders.
So, Sean, I hope you're going to give me some good news. What can be done politically?
Well, there are some efforts that that I've been lucky to be involved with. One of them is Science Debate. You can find us at sciencedebate.org. What we're working on there is to get the candidates for president as well as members of Congress that are on the key science policy committees to commit to debate these issues like climate change, like energy, so that the public can make informed decisions. And these people are very happy to debate economics, they're happy to debate foreign policy, they're happy to debate religion, but very rarely are they asked any questions about science and science policy, and that's what's really determining our future. So we're kind of blindly, boldly going forward, and this is a way to help bridge that gap. So I'd encourage you to go to sciencedebate.org and sign on to that effort. It's all run by volunteers. The other thing that you could do is on my own website, seanotto.com, there's something called the American Science Pledge. And that is a pledge that candidates for office can be asked to sign on to, where they will commit to using science and reason instead of ideology and politics to make decisions in the best interests of everyone. I think that we have, in our crazy weather that we've seen over the last 8 or 9 months, seen a large shift begin in the public attitude about whether or not climate change is real. I see the dialogue happening amongst the deniers now really focusing more on what we can afford or cannot afford to do about it. And that's really where the discussion should have been all along, because that's a legitimate policy economic question then. So I think that we are moving in the right direction, and any nudging that can be done to focus on the economics of it, I think that that will help it along.
And that's our time. Thanks to everyone for coming.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.